Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started. First of all, my name is not Julie Shu. My name is Warren Johnson, and I'm a lead program manager on the Cloud Manageability team. I've been on Exchange for about 6 years. It's been a very interesting time being back at MEC. This is definitely not Orlando. I think it was a pretty fun night on Tuesday. Coming from the Pacific Northwest, we really appreciate good microbrews. And I think we were not disappointed. I think there was 100 microbrews at one place. And I remember thinking that I feel a little bit sorry for anybody who had to do the Tuesday morning session. And so I looked at the schedule kind of before I went to bed that night, and I noticed 9 a.m. Tuesday morning, public folders. So in the business, sometimes we say that, if we look at a defect, sometimes we look at that and we say, is that a feature or is that a bug? So, I don't know if it was by design, but I heard it was a spirited conversation based on Tony's blog. So that's great. I hope this can be a spirited conversation as well. And I've got a pretty good-sized group today, but let's keep it interactive. So I hope that if you take one thing away from today's talk, is that although you've heard the message really loud and clear today, or the whole week really, that we're cloud first from a sense of putting things out there earlier, that we can get your feedback sooner and move a little bit faster, that's not at the expense of taking care of on-premises orgs. So that's very much on our mind, and I see people from the supportability team here today, so they keep us really, really honest all the time. And I think a lot of people that come to MEC are large org enterprise admins, so you are our base, and so we want to keep you as strong supporters. So a few things on the docket for today. As you can see, I'm very, very happy to talk about an old friend returning, and we'll get to that in a moment, and we'll demo a little bit. And I think some of you have maybe seen our old friend if you've already got the SP1 bits for 2013 in your org, or you've maybe read some of the blog posts. That was a very polarizing issue, maybe not even polarizing because of the fact that I think there was mainly the last MEC that I spoke at, there was a very, how do I say, visceral reaction. That was a spirited discussion around that old friend. But we'll also talk a little bit about some more kind of 300-level stuff around how routing works for the ECP protocol at the protocol head from the CAS servers, and some tips and tricks that if you notice some weird things when you first tried to sign in maybe to Exchange after getting an interop environment, why that would be. And I'm going to even talk about some things, what I hate to call them secrets. I think they are documented, but they will apply both to remote PowerShell and to EAC. And when I talk today, if I ever say ECP, the Exchange Control Panel, that's really our name just for the protocol for manageability. In fact, if you look at your IIS installs, you'll see that the name of the virtual directory is in fact ECP. But the marketing name for the console, both on-premises, hybrid, and the cloud, is the Exchange Admin Center. So that's really how we differentiate. And I'll talk briefly a little bit about what the kind of unique qualities are, the different deployments, whether they're on-prem, hybrid, or cloud, what you can expect to find where, and I'll summarize maybe some of the best practices, particularly if you're in a hybrid environment. I know there was a whole other great session that Ranil led for that. So there's a lot more information if you couldn't attend that. And then very common topic, I always get two very common questions, I think, when I'm on the floor. One is about how RBAC permissions work, and I get a lot of feedback about what you can do in the console versus what you can do in PowerShell, and how recipient scopes work, and OU scopes, and scopes with servers and that kind of stuff, how they work. So I'm going to summarize a little bit of that and then give a demo, particularly with scopes that will be in EAC and in PowerShell. And finally, I would be remiss in this conference if I didn't talk a little bit about the uniqueness of what it means to be an admin, a tenant admin, an IT admin, which all of you are, for groups. And I'll talk a little bit about the kind of what some of the decisions that we've made so far and what you can expect to see coming down the road pretty soon if you're also a cloud admin. And finally, I will punctuate the talk by giving a little bit of a roadmap in the spirit of cloud first about what you can expect to see in 365 as it impacts Exchange Online. So there is a reason why I'm talking about this first, I think. But I'm very, very happy to say, and I know many of you know this already, but the PowerShell Log Viewer is back. And Yes, feel free to applaud. I hope after the last mech you would applaud when I said that. So, you know, bottom line is, we heard you guys loud and clear. And if you look at comments like this from this fellow, who we all know very well, and I will tell you that, you know, to be honest, we read all press, and we read all criticism, and we read everything written about EAC and about Exchange. And so Tony was very, very clear. And I think that particularly the second comment that he made, where he was talking about that we're disappointing both ends of the spectrum, both the kind of novice users, which I found very interesting, that the novice, even people who are kind of new to Exchange, even you guys want to learn about PowerShell. I mean, but it makes a lot of sense when I thought about it. You want to enhance your capabilities and your value to your org, as well as the people who already know PowerShell. So I guess Tony's short story was that we had disappointed both sides, and also that his last comment, it's a sad omission. So hopefully no one has to be sad anymore, particularly Tony. Don't want to have any, it's not a good best practice to have your users be sad. So we're very happy that this has come back, and I'll be giving a short demo of that today. So in a nutshell, it's really, really intuitive to use, but I just want to talk a little bit about where you can expect to find it and kind of what's there. But really where we came from with this was, especially given the comments at the last mech, was ensuring that we at least had that fundamental parity with what you had seen in the Exchange Management Console in 2010. And that, you know, that's really a very common pattern that I've had in several cases, particularly with recipient management, doing exported views, the ability to search and filter. But I can say with this addition, because I joined the team on the Exchange Manageability side, and yes, we have a whole team pretty much around that. I joined around the time we were doing SP1 for Exchange 2007, and at that time we were also working on 2010. And speaking of 2007, can anyone name the kind of two major updates that happened in the manageability space for 2007? Anybody? The first one was very near and dear to Vivek Sharma's heart. PowerShell? And can anyone, for extra credit, guess which version of PowerShell? Local PowerShell. And that was a departure. In 2010, of course, now you could remote up into the cloud. It's remote PowerShell. But in 2007, that was a revolutionary time in itself. The introduction of the Exchange Management Console, predecessor, was the system manager. So every time, you know, we talk about this, we have something new to talk about. But the introduction, and this was work that my team had done at that time too, in 2010 was this management, PowerShell logger. So we're happy to bring it back. So first, how do you find it? It's very easy to find. If you just look in the standard help links under the question mark, you'll see show the command logger. And so you can just open that. And one piece of advice there is that it doesn't start logging, writing the commands to that PowerShell logging console until you open it up, basically, the first time. And so just a few more details. There's a few basic operations that you can do. So as soon as you open it up, and as soon as you start doing something in the console, and keep in mind that this is only capturing what is in your current session for EAC. So if you're also doing things in parallel in a remote PowerShell session or in another session or something like that, it's not going to also capture that. And it's also volatile, so it's not going to cache this list and keep it around forever. And I think that's a really important thing to understand, because one thing I want to talk about what this is really not intended for is that it's not a replacement for any kind of auditing tools you have in your org today. And so you're not going to be like, if you're being investigated by the IRS or the FBI or the CIA or whomever you're being investigated by these days, you can't take a dump of the PowerShell log viewer and then say, okay, here you go, here's what we did. It's definitely not intended for that. And so for auditing, I highly, highly recommend that if you weren't there to hear Kamal's great talk on that entire space, and there were different parts of that, like Quentin's talk on eDiscovery as well, talk to those guys. We have a very, you know, robust suite-level compliance suite too, but this is not part of that. So there's other basic things that you can do. If you find yourself getting kind of lost in the woods as far as tons of information, although there's a 500-row limit for performance reasons in this kind of cache that we use to maintain this list, you can easily just clear that list. And I think that's a really good feature, because a lot of times when you're going to want to use this is you're wondering, maybe you need to create an RBAC role, or you're writing a script, that's kind of what it's for, and you want to know how you can correlate something in the UI part of the user experience to what's actually going on under the hood. Particularly for operations like even just editing a property page for a user, and we call things like set user, you'll see there are a lot of parameters involved. And so if you're wondering kind of what correlates to what field, you can use this, you can kind of clear it and then say, okay, I see that when I save the property page, it's calling set user, and then here's the different parameters, and then you can makes it easier to find stuff in there. So you can also search based on if you know the commandlet that you're looking for, like management role or management scope or something like that. If you're trying to do something with RBAC in bulk, you can just go ahead and then the search term that we support is the verb dash the noun. So you have to put the whole term in there. There's not a partial match of that, but you can search on the commandlet. You cannot export the list today. That's a great bit of feedback. You can cut and paste from the bottom pane. Sorry? Sorry, one more time. Great. I should have mentioned that. Thanks for that question. Absolutely. I don't show it here. I'll show it in the demo. If you select the entire list, then the bottom pane is where you could just do a cut and paste, and it would grab your entire history pretty easily. So with that said, I'll give a quick demo, and I will cover that as well. All right, so let me just get into EAC. All right, so here's where our old friend lives. Show command logging. This is a pretty small resolution. I mean, we always optimize our demos for these, like, on these huge screens, and then we get up in front of you guys, and then it's like a tiny resolution. But the way I like to use it personally is that we intentionally designed the kind of form factor of the log view, and you can change the size a little bit when it pops up, that it's nice to kind of have it side by side. You guys all have like 10 monitors and then huge, you know, resolutions and that kind of stuff. So you can just have it side by side, and you can kind of see what's going on in the background. So here I've started the logging, and I am going to have to just switch back and forth a little bit. But if I do some basic operations, like let's say I get the recipients list, or let's say I'm looking at this guy's properties, then what you will notice here is that a bunch of stuff happened. So you can sort. The way I like to do a lot of times too is that you can kind of put the stuff that happened last at the top, or the default order as well. And you can kind of see what commandlets I had run. So you can see in the last case, I was getting this guy's mailbox. Now, one important piece of feedback, and so Tony has written a follow-up blog post, by the way, in Unwashed, specifically about how to use this. And so he's had some comments in there, too. And so one thing I want to touch on is that you're really seeing exactly how we used the remote partial run space under the hood. And so because of that, you'll see that we use the identity of the unique objects, so particularly like the user mailbox. So we don't refer to things like as, you know, Bob Smith, usually, or whatever. The unique, because it could be a lot of Bob Smiths, and there are. But so we refer to things with their globally unique identifier, the GUID, in most cases. So just bear that in mind if you're doing a cut and paste. And so to answer this gentleman's question, we did think of that particular scenario. So what you can do here is that in the simplest case, I could just go and cut and paste this guy here into PowerShell. Oops. Let's say I paste him into a script. Okay, so let's say I was just keeping a list going of stuff that was happening here. And then based on this gentleman's question, I could just select the whole list, just say Control A, go down here, select the list, and then be ready to rock. And then, as I said, you could do a simple search, and it was really kind of a filter based on that verb and noun pattern for the commandlet. And then I could blow it away and start fresh again. All right, so let's shift gears a little bit and switch into more kind of 300 level territory. So I want to talk a little bit about, since I know that there is I've looked at the numbers, and I look at the numbers a lot. I know pretty much at a macro view, like how many of you are on 2010, how many of you are on 2013, how many are you are on 2013, 2010, and 2007, and even how many are maybe are still in older versions. That's something we track pretty closely. So I want to talk a little bit about how, from a routing perspective of the protocol head, and as far as using the console, that this really works. So one thing I'm not going to talk too much about today is I'm not going to like show the matrix and like you can do what, where. If you have questions about that, please, I'll be down to the expo after this, or we can talk about it one-on-one, or I can show you the matrix, like what you can do from which console. In a nutshell, that's pretty easy to explain anyway. Just always, for best practice, if you're in an interoperability environment, just always use the highest level console you have. So in this case, it would be the 2013 SP2 insert the CU that you have installed. Always use that. You can pretty much do everything there, especially for recipients, with the exception of the individual server management, which should be done natively to the individual consoles. So there's one guy sitting in the audience right now that I borrowed this slide from, and I like to refer to this as our lucky 13, maybe not so lucky 13. And this guy, the guy that put this together, he traveled a long way to come work with my team and start talking about the interoperability problem space. And the way he framed it very visually really, really drove the issue home. That this person came and said, look, this is where we are today. It takes 13 consoles to manage this interoperability with version N, N-1, N-2. So with these three flavors of Exchange. Is that really the direction we want to go? And we said, no, not really. So that's why I can tell you today, we've got it down to more or less about 2, or really 1 plus 1, 1 plus plus. So as I've said, you want to use your E2013 SP1 console EAC to do the majority of your manageability, with the exception of kind of individual server objects, but that also includes things like organizational objects. And if you're curious about the way that versioning works on an individual object basis, or version bumping, if you've seen that kind of stuff, or you know how versioning works like in store objects versus AD objects, I'm very, very happy to talk about that one-on-one as well, and I can give you examples. But this is just really where we're coming from, the interop macro view, before we get into the technical, more detailed stuff, is that you really just use the 2013 SP1 console plus PowerShell if you want. Okay, so I just want to talk about some fundamental routing concepts, and I think I didn't go to the client access server talks this time around, but you probably heard the kind of big picture of how this works for every single protocol. So I'll be talking about how this works for the ECP protocol, the protocol that EAC uses in an interop environment. And I'll be talking a little bit about some tips and tricks about how this works with remote PowerShell as well. So the most fundamental thing that if you're trying to get your mind around, like, why am I being routed where, even if I'm an admin, is that you have to understand that as you probably heard at some of the CAS talks, front-end server talks, proxy talks, is that what dictates where you get routed is based on anchor mailbox affinity. And that's a kind of nice way, or kind of interesting linguistic way to say that wherever your mailbox lives, if you have a mailbox, I know a lot of you don't, or that you have mail user accounts, if that's what your org dictates. But basically, wherever your mailbox lives is where you're going to be routed. And that applies to both end users, information workers, your customers, your users, and yourselves. Now, in the mail user case, this also applies, and hold that thought just for a second, but I'll explain kind of how that works. So, in a nutshell, when you hit your load balancer, then that gets proxied to your front door, and I think that we've all seen the best practices that when you're doing a deployment, I think there's a lot of steps involved. One of the steps is definitely making the 2013 CAS server the front door, so that all of this routing comes into play in an interop environment. So in this case, if you have a bunch of ECP admins and they all have, some guys are on the latest stuff, some are on 2010, some are on 2007, they could all be routed a different place depending on where their mailbox lives. Or in the special case, not really special case for you guys, is a lot of you are large organization admins. A lot of you have just credentials, what we call mail user credentials, where you just have your Bob_admin, so that they can keep a record of who did what, and maybe your mailbox doesn't actually live there. So if you're just a mail user, like for example, I have when I do a lot of administration, then you still have a version associated with your mailbox, or sorry, with your user info, because a mailbox is kind of a logical concept anyway, where you half of it is sort of AD and half of it is the in the physical store. But in this case, you don't have that physical store. So the way that that works in a mail user is that we stamp the version based on the arbitration system mailbox of where that mail user account was created. And so if that's a confusing or weird concept, talk to me later about that. But just know that when your mailbox gets migrated, that we're going to update that version. So it basically won't be there forever if you've moved from 2007 to 2010 to 2013. Every time that mailbox migration happens successfully, one of the last things we do is update the version stamped associated with that admin mailbox or that mail user account. Okay. So just as an example, you can see that if there's a 2010 admin who has a mailbox at the protocol head on the CAS server, they are going to get routed right away to 2010. But, and I just want to, this is a really common question that I get asked, is and I'll show kind of how you might fall into this traps and pitfall in the demo and some kind of niceties that we've added fairly recently. But if you use this override key value pair, and I'll show you, and you don't have to remember this now because of a nice feature that we've added when we do the install that I'll show you. But there's a special key value pair, exchange client version equals major version, that you can use to do what we call explicit version routing, really. So you're saying, like, hey, I know that I have like a mailbox or arbitration system mailbox associated with my account that is based on 2010. And yes, there is like, picking up on this, a kind of a small issue. You can see that this was homegrown because we use the internal kind of object level naming thing. So if you look at like, if you do get mailbox FL or get user in your name, and you'll see like 14.1. Whatever. So we use that naming convention, which is our internal one, not our marketing version. So just, I mean, I know you guys all are very aware of what the kind of a 15 object is or 14.1. So just be aware that the major version you're using here is either going to be 15 to say, yep, I always want to make sure I'm using the latest and greatest version, or 14. I'll show some examples of that in the demo. Okay, and the same story if somebody's coming in from 2007, because I know a lot of you guys sometimes will skip a version, so maybe you're going from like 2007 to 2013, so it will work for you guys as well. And so just a quick summary of kind of how some of this logic works. Just want to point out that if your end users are really super savvy, and if they're still, say, on 2007 or earlier version, or let's say they're on 2010, and I think most people here probably have figured out that when your end users are using OWA options to do things like their automatic replies or set up inbox rules or apps, you're actually using the ECP protocol. But you're using a version that has the same kind of CSS and the kind of niceties associated with it to make it work really well with OWA for a seamless experience. But they're not using the OWA virtual directory in that case. They're using ECP. So if those guys try to be very clever and also use this, it doesn't work for them. Because we look at the refer or the RFR, and if it comes from OWA, then we just ignore it, basically. So, and it only works if you're an admin. All right. So. Let me just show a little bit in practice for how this works, and I want to show one tip that you may not have seen kind of documented in a lot of places today. Actually, let me use this one instead. So let me just sign out here, because I think a lot of people, I just want to point out, this is my own comment on this, I would say, not the official. There's only one administrator, this built-in administrator account, and that doesn't, and there's only, like I say, there's only one, and so you would need to move that kind of one of the last things you do. So I know a lot of you don't use this, but if you're a really small business, I just would just say my own best practice is say, like, don't use this account, unless you really have to, because it's sort of like last good configuration. So I would normally, the first thing I would do is, if you just installed Exchange for the first time, is you might be tempted to use this guy, but I would say don't. Just create somebody else and then, or use this guy for the first time login and then create your own mailbox or move from somewhere else and then make that guy that person an admin. So in this case, I'm going to use a 2010 admin, And this is an admin named Lore. And so Lore is really excited about, oh, she's finally got 2013 working, all the prereqs, everything looks good. She's signing on for the first time, and then, this looks a lot like Exchange 2010. So I don't know how many people have seen this. This is a common question that I get asked, and they're saying, like, I thought that I installed something new. What's going on here, actually? And so this is a case where you'd want to use the explicit routing. Or I want to show a nice feature, and now I remember why I was going to show this version of it. If you look to where I've installed Exchange, we've actually, so this is a parity question. Again, we've finally added a shortcut to EAC in the install that has the pre-built, you can see that it's encoded into to the URI here. So if I log in with Lore again, and so this shortcut has that Exchange client version equals 15, the highest version. So if you're wondering what it was, it's got it baked in, so all you gotta do is just click it and then sign in. Oops. And now she's on 15. And for whatever reason, and you shouldn't really need to do this, I think, in most cases, particularly since if you're really managing a server or server object in 2010, you'd really be using the Exchange Management Console. But if for whatever reason you needed to switch to the previous 2010, internally the object is 14, you can switch right on the fly. And it's pretty fast. And one thing I want to point out is that when you are doing help desk management of another, if a lot of you have these big orgs where you use help desk for things like resetting people's passwords or setting their OOF messages, if I'm going to manage another user that is on the previous version, we have some smarts in the way we treat versioning. I'll show you very briefly, so that you're still seeing, from the OOptions perspective, you're seeing what your user would see. So in this case, I'm logged on as myself. I'm an admin on 2013. I can look up Lore here. And so there she is. So if I want to manage, I just got a call from her. She's on vacation. Hey, sorry, I forgot to set my my OOF message. So I can do quick management for her. And so you see, even though I'm a 2013 admin, I still see exactly what she would have seen. And this is actually very, very useful because people call you up and you say, like, okay, go and click here. And then it's like, oh, actually, you know, it's much more helpful if you see exactly what they're seeing. So the last one thing I want to leave you with on explicit routing is I need to go mech for a second here. So let's go back to Lore, and let's not use explicit routing. So okay, we don't want that. So I'm specifically not using this. All right. Okay, so I showed you before that when Lore gets dropped into the 2010 ECP experience, that you could also use the Exchange client version. But something else that she can do is another special routing override that hasn't been talked too much in the press. I think it's documented, but it's useful in a slightly different way. I think a lot of times the other question I get from people is, if I'm having a CAS problem, how do I debug that problem? Because of the fact that if I have a big pool of CAS servers, it works on random routing and based on load and that kind of stuff, a number of connections. But what if I really need to just go straight to a particular server called Foo and see, is that one okay? Well, today I'm here to tell you that you can do that. And it works very similar to the way the Exchange client version routing works, is that you specify what's called target server. And I've just forgotten which version this one is. Oops. Sorry. That's not okay. And the other thing I need to point out is definitely don't do exactly what I just did there. You need to use the fully qualified domain name. So let me make sure I'm using the right one. Actually, I think I can do it from here too. So now I'm actually using the FQDN. And now based on the FQDN, I routed not based on random proxying, although I've got kind of a simple topology here. Try this at home if you have like 5 CAS servers. I specified the FQDN, and I went exactly to that server. That's where I was routed. So that's a really useful thing for debugging, because maybe the external URL or the internal URL on the ECP virtual directory appears to be messed up. You can now, as the admin, go and look at that yourself, at least for the ECP protocol. That also works, by the way, the exact same way using target server for remote PowerShell. And so that's useful for debugging there. Obviously, that doesn't work in the cloud, because we don't expose the server names to you, and that's just something we take care of ourselves. All right. So I want to just take a few minutes and talk about different varieties of deployments that we have and kind of best practices and how they're a little bit unique in some cases. So the way that I would describe on-premises, and I know this is very near and dear to many of you, is that on-premises really has everything for the most part, except in one special regard. So this is on-premises, of course, is where you're doing all of your user and recipient, organizational policies, retention, all of that kind of stuff at the level of Exchange, where you're doing all of your DAG management, server virtual directories, all your high availability stuff. You know, you guys run the show pretty much there, or use a partner solution. What does it not have? In most cases, unless you might be using a partner solution or something else, but in most cases, you don't have that, what we keep talking about at Mech, that suite level integration where you get an all-up list of users, not in Active Directory users and computers, et cetera, but you don't really have that view all up from Office that you're seeing, here's my one place for my SharePoint site collections and my all-up guest users and integrated kind of reports unless you've added that on. So that's kind of the one thing. So you're really kind of either focused at what we say the workload admin centers. So if you're on-premises, then you're really just thinking about Exchange, SharePoint, managing Link, everything else that you may have. So if you're in hybrid, this is what I would call everything plus plus, because you have a little bit more as well. Chances are, if you are in what we call rich coexistence mode, we're not calling it advanced coexistence anymore. It's a rich experience. If you're in rich coexistence cross-premises, AKA hybrid, then you also have things like Exchange Azure Active Directory, which is a great product, I think, and I feel like I should plug it a little bit because of the fact that I know a lot of you guys are using things like ADFS 2.0 in the past to do single sign-on. It has a great feature that our team collaborated a little bit with them on for managing up in the cloud to do password sync. And so that was something that I think got announced earlier in the year at a tech ed. So DirSync is directory sync is easier to use, but that's what you're using in hybrid. Also with hybrid, integrated into the on-premises console today, there's a tab at the bottom. Some of you probably played with it a little bit, hybrid. And so if you went to the talk that Tim and Andrew and Ranil gave yesterday, the excellent hybrid talk, I think you probably were all there because there was like 450 people at that talk, as there always is at hybrid. Then you saw that they talked about what was going on behind the scenes with the hybrid config engine, but then also the hybrid config wizard. And so the wizard is integrated into the on-premises client here in that last tab for hybrid. And so I won't demo that today. There was a great video and kind of demo that those guys had shown. But it's very simple. You just click it, and the hybrid config object is created. And then I just also plug the fact that it's stateless. So if you do something, you can go back and do it again. It's always aware of what you have done and what you need to do to get hybrid working. And then also for hybrid, your one-stop shopping for manageability of hybrid is to use is once you've run the hybrid config wizard, run the hybrid config engine, then the EAC client on-premises goes into hybrid mode. And so also in Ranil's demo, then you saw that you can switch between tabs, but you get an all-up recipient list from the on-premises side. And so again, the best practice there, and you'll actually be prevented from doing this, but the best practice is that In a lot of cases, in most cases, with a kind of a few exceptions, the directory synchronization is happening between those recipient objects on premises to the cloud. It's mostly kind of one way. So when you're making recipient level changes in your hybrid deployments, make those from the enterprise tab in on premises. But you will see them also in 365. Oh, sorry, I forgot to talk about cloud. So, okay, you can see from what we talked about previously, the cloud, the way I would talk about this a little bit is like, it's kind of everything that you don't want, but then everything maybe more than, you know, it's stuff that you do want. So of course, in the cloud, we obfuscate the high availability and the DAGs and the virtual directories and the servers, where I think a lot of you guys on premises spend, my data says that you spend maybe like a lot of your time, maybe like 80% of your time, swapping out hard drives and that kind of stuff. So you don't need to do any physical management, don't need to do any certificate management of that kind of work in the cloud, just recipients, organization policy. And the key difference being what it has is in 365, which I will show a little demo of how that applies to Exchange towards the end, is that it has that suite level manageability. And I think that's really our secret sauce in the cloud, or one of our secret sauces. So you'll see, or you may have seen us talking a lot about this week, particularly for some cool things like the way that we have devices, all devices across the org, integrated, and I saw a demo of this earlier in the week. In the devices tab in 365, just I want to see everybody's mobile phone, tablets, everything like that, everything coming from EAC, and I want to see that at the org level. That's a great example of what you can expect to see a lot more of in the 365 console. Okay, so now I want to bring it back to sort of 300 level land again, and talk a little bit about how permissions management for authorization of both your end users and your IT department, or also including your admins like compliance officers. So you probably heard the word compliance officer a lot this week if you went to Kamal's talk or Quentin's talk. All right, so I'll give a little background again. I know a lot of people are pretty familiar at this point on how roles-based access control works and what it's not. So if you think about the way that sometimes the versioning works on your Exchange store, like if you're granting someone full permissions, et cetera, that kind of stuff, it can be a lot about ACLs and ACEs, access control lists. These people can do these things, these people can't. So that's sort of how this authorization kind of came from, but that's really not how it works. So back a couple years ago, and when we started talking about roles-based access control, what we really wanted to do was create something that was a permissions model that aligned more to what the user's job was, and not just a list of the standard kind of ACL list that you get, like if you do calendar sharing or something like that. And even that's getting easier. So it should align to that user. If they're a help desk user, you could probably pick the pre-canned RBAC role group for help desk. Or if they're a compliance officer, if they read your email, if they're one of those guys, then they should have their permissions where they're able to do that. And there's different tiers of how this works, and a lot of customization, and a lot of stuff maybe that's in there that you weren't even aware of, based on talking to people on the expo. So I want to get into a little bit of detail on some of this, what you can do where. So I just mentioned that really RBAC is about who can do what where. So this is about that the help desk guy who works in Austin is able to do reset password. And so a lot of this stuff, I want to emphasize that I think a lot of this works pretty well out of the box. And you can see that we've definitely thought of that Ubi experience by the fact that there's heaps of RBAC role groups created for you after you install Exchange, and there's heaps of roles. And so I'll talk a little bit about the difference between what it means to configure a role group versus what it means to configure a role. And I'll punctuate this part of the RBAC talk by talking about scopes a little bit, which I think are still a little bit confusing. I think a lot of people want to use what scopes provide, and there's certain things you can do in EAC and some things you can't. But configuring them is actually pretty easy. A lot of you are partial level users, so I'll just summarize a little bit of that. I think I realized later that I misnamed this slide a little poorly. So what I was really getting at on this slide, and I'll go back and update the deck, is I was just underlying the fact that we have roles-based access control for Exchange in the cloud as well. So you still have very finely grained control if you're a big org and you know, people in Berlin can do certain stuff and then people in Austin can do other things, or maybe these for these type of operations. We don't deal with the server-like scope type stuff in the cloud for obvious reasons. But just know that you have that full fidelity of RBAC in the cloud. And I'll also talk a little bit of detail, especially in the demo, about what it means to do authorization and permissions management from the 365 level, because I think that's another big question that I get from a lot of people. And if also people want more hands-on stuff, I can talk about that offline. Because we have a pretty, currently, we have a pretty chunky model for how authorization works at the suite level. I think there's maybe five roles you could do, like if you're a global admin, but they all map to something and they all have meaning within Exchange. And so sometimes you see kind of, if you're in the cloud, you see kind of a name that looks a little bit interesting and you're wondering where that is. It's probably come from the synchronization that happens from the suite. And so I can talk more about that too. Okay, so like I said, thinking about what you can do where in the broad strokes. So suite level management, this is this, you create a user. One cool thing about the suite is that unlike if you're using EAC to do the admin, IT admin updates to add somebody, it's a two-step process. You create the mailbox, or maybe you created the user in AD already, and then you attach a mailbox to it. So it's a two-step to go into permissions. But in the suite, it's one-stop shopping. So you just create the user, and then you can say, is the user an admin or not? And then there's just five choices or so. And so if you create that user as a global admin, you know, for example, they all have a mapping in Exchange. So think of that as like organizational management. And so most things having to do at the role group in RBAC, you can do within EAC directly. So if you want to create a new one, if you want to clone an existing one, if you want to edit one, that's no problem. You can do that through EAC for the most part, and you don't need to supplement that too much with PowerShell. And I'll show one important feature I think a lot of you have seen, which is the copy, where a lot of times it's good to just, if you think that the new role group, which is the container of roles, is close to what you actually want to do, like if you're going to create a new reset password or sort of help desk role group, and but you just want to add it for some other guys like in Austin but not in Seattle or something like that with an explicit or implicit scope, then you can start by just copying the role group. And so that's a nice place to get started. So other things, assigning. I didn't talk about end users yet, but for end users, it's very simple. In a lot of cases, you want to just say, these executives can modify their AD information, they can change their organization, they can change their picture or their department. These people can't. These people can control things like distribution lists, these guys can't. So the way you do that for end users is through RAPs, role assignment policies. And those are easy to assign, you just do that through your recipients. Management, but keep in mind that's for IWs, and of course you can be an IW and an admin. So you will always have a role assignment policy and an RBAC role group generally assigned to an individual user. I mentioned creating a new group RBAC role group from scratch. You can do that. You can also copy creating a new RBAC role. So here we get into like Evan Dodd's Vivek Sharma territory, whom I talked about this a little bit because we're on the same plane. Coming from Seattle. So for an RBAC role, I won't be demoing how to create one of those from the ground up, but I'll just say that there's, we can talk about that offline if you want. There was a really good, I think, RBAC talk yesterday afternoon that was sort of scenario based, and I think they covered that too. So you can do this. This is a great place to use the PowerShell logging tool if you're gonna be doing this, and then still double check that it means what you think it means. But because of the fact that RBAC is the RBAC roles are completely based on the commandlets, which noun, verb, noun, commandlet that you can do, and then restriction of individual parameters within those, and then scoping them. So that's roles. You need to do that in PowerShell. So that also goes for editing an existing RBAC role. And there's some things you can do and some things you can't do that depending on the parent of that particular role. And we can talk about that more in detail if you want. And then scopes get interesting. And this is another question. This I will demo today, creating a scope, because I think it's important. It's important functionality in the where part, especially for OUs. So if you've already created recipient scopes or OU-based scopes or on-premises server ones, then you're good to go, basically, because we expose those scopes when you're creating a RBAC role group in the cloud, and so you can just assign them. But if you and there's some default ones, default explicit scopes, but if you haven't created those, you might be thinking, how do I do that? And so the assignment of a scope to an RBAC role group can be done in the console, in the UI, but the creation of those ones. And so I'll demo that really briefly, because actually pretty easy and pretty flexible, which is usually a hard combination. But it's pretty simple to use. So with that, I'll just go into a little detail here with RBAC. So for this demo, I am going to use a 2013 SP1 user. So we're really just going to talk about three or four things pretty quickly. So in general, all of the authorization that I've talked about, both for end users and for IT users, can be done through the permissions tab. You can sort of see the importance of it that we basically put it in our information architecture right under recipients. So again, I think this stuff is pretty simple, but just for end users, every end user basically inherits from a particular RBAC role. It's kind of I should have probably put this in the deck as well. But if you see my base options, every IW end user will be assigned that. And so, I think you might get an error if you try to do this anyway. But I'd say don't remove that role if you don't want to break certain things, particularly the way that they work with OAuth options. And in fact, under the hood, when we're classifying kind of who is an admin, IT admin, or even a compliance officer, and who is just a standard end user, we really look to see if my base options is their only one. So these guys all have my base options. If I wanted to create a new role assignment policy, you can see that I could do this. One thing to caution you a little bit about is that based on feedback we've had is that this starts with a pretty restrictive model for role assignment policies, is that we don't have, there's no default configuration. And so you have to go in and add, and some of these are okay, so that you can say all right, they can edit their contact information and you understand that. But then the reason why I was just pointing the last one is that I think in 99% of the cases that you're ever creating a new role assignment policy for the executive group or the group called Foo, I would always give them my base options because we in the code we really rely on this one to do a lot of basic stuff, and you will probably have a broken experience if you create a role assignment policy without my base options. So we may be looking at an update where we tick that by default, but just be careful with that, I would say. On the admin side, so going back to that matrix that I talked about, so you can see, just to be really clear, we call this admin roles. Under the hood, this list is RBAC role groups. So again, they're containers. So we don't list these hierarchically. They're just kind of alphabetically sorted in the list. But organization management is going to be your kind of God mode one, although it is missing certain roles by default, by design. So for example, just even if you're an organizational manager, you don't get the discovery roles. You don't get to automatically read people's email. And so in the UI, a common operation you want to do is just say who's got this assigned to them currently. So it's pretty easy. We call this the details pane. And so in a quick glance at this one view, I'm able to say, okay, it looks like this guy's got every single role except for the discovery stuff. And then here are the admins, basically. And also, if you're in an interop environment, you can also use this, because this is really kind of a front end to what's going on in AD permissions management, too. So you can assign this to your down-level admins, too. So in this case, you notice that Lore was a 2010 admin. I can grant her permissions here, too. And so I was going to mention, and of course, here's the key compliance role for discovery management. But one of my favorite features here is the ability to just do a copy operation. And so if you're going to modify something, but then particularly if you're going to change the where part of it, if you, in the second part of this, we'll talk about scopes. But then if I was going to give something to just a particular OU or a remote office, then I could do that. So when I'm doing the copy, one thing I want to point out is that in a scope, there can be a component of that based on the filtering that applies only to a certain OU, but you can also create that based on OU. So today, you may have noticed that we've added what we call a picker when we do user creation so that you can provision that into a particular OU container. We don't have that same picker today. So basically, for the group edit, so you have to basically add it with its kind of fully qualified domain. So that might be something we look at fixing, because we do have the ability to just enumerate that whole tree, but it hasn't just made it to this part of it yet. So you could just get your list of OUs from somewhere like Active Directory or wherever you like to get that from, and you just need to put that path in today. So this group of users, this role group, I'm just going to create with a default scope, and I'm just going to add myself to it for now. Or actually, let's say I'll add Laura. And then we'll let this one bake for a second, and then we'll use it again in just a minute. Oops. OK. And so by default, when you copy something, it's just going to show up as a copy of whatever. So I probably could have renamed it. All right, so we'll let this guy hang out here for just a moment. And one more thing I wanted to just show here is that I've talked about the fact that you can't really get into too much detail with roles themselves, not groups, but the roles. But one thing you can see is that you can see all the roles that are currently available in the deployment through here. And so this is kind of a nice teaching aid as well. So this was accessible through the property page of the role group. And you can see we also use our details pane pattern here, and so there's a description of what it does. Description is nice, but I'd say like always go to the really detailed documentation about what PowerShell commands and what parameters, just to avoid giving somebody access to something that maybe you didn't want to. But every single role is basically, it's available to you to kind of see what's going on. So there's probably a bunch of compliance ones here too that you can investigate. So that's sort of a nice learning tool like the PowerShell logger. Okay. So lastly, I just want to show two things very briefly. So this is what I got Vivek's blessing on the plane to give a partial demo as well. So let me just go back to something that I created earlier. Okay. So here you can see that in the past, I had created a management scope, again, around the kind of where who can do this as a way to pivot that. So this was one maybe that I called the Seattle Help Desk, because as you can see in the fully qualified path for the OU containers, like Seattle was in here. But let's say I want to do one of these guys for MEC, and it's only people in Austin, in MEC and in Austin. All right, and so you could see it's a pretty simple operation. It's just new management scope, and then there's part of our. If you're familiar with a lot of our commandlets have this recipient filter language built into it. And so in this case, I'm just saying it's a required parameter, but I'm just using the simplest possible version of it, where the recipient type is user mailbox, so everybody has user mailbox. And then the root here is based on the container. So in this case, I'm just going to do a quick edit. And it's everybody who's in Austin. And also in MEC. Okay, so it's pretty fast. And then you can quickly see which scopes I've already got. This is in the UI as well. But you can see there's a couple of custom ones that I've created here, Redmond Help Desk, Seattle Help Desk, and then these MEC users. So now, if we go back to the UI, and I'm logging in as myself again. And so now, if we go back to that role group that we just created, MEC user, super users. So the way that we can apply a scope to this So we can just go to the write scope and say mech users, and then save it. You could also apply that new scope that we created in PowerShell, but it's one of those kind of policy things that, if you had like an organizational structure where you wanted to apply different ones based on either OUs or recipient filters, just people that manage room mailboxes, for example, then you could easily do that through the UI. Okay, now some of the fun stuff too to talk about. So I don't have a live demo for the groups work that we're doing in the admin space, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the guiding principles and show you a glimpse ahead. I'm going to be really crystal clear on this one, is that this is a place where, because it's something that's actively in development, I would love to hear your feedback on it, especially one-on-one, down in the expo or whatever, because it's a very unique situation, I think, for groups, is that really we want this to be great from an end-user perspective, and as you've seen, all the kind of bottom-up driven work, but we want you as the IT admin to be our strongest partner. And so we want to make sure that you feel like you are being taken care of in this experience. And so I'll point to a few things that in the experience that where we're trying to do that. So first and foremost, Andrew Friedman and Sonia talked a little bit about this at the end of their talk yesterday on groups. But one of the awareness principles, since in a lot of cases, we're hoping that 90% of the time, once you feel comfortable about this, that 90% of the time your end users can just run with this, collaborate, and the org will reap the value of that. But taking care of you as the admin, you are going to get an all-up list of all groups across the org in the cloud. And so it's likely that in subsequent rollouts, and if when we first release this, if it doesn't have every single feature that you feel like you're in love with, like a really advanced filtering, wait another month, we're going to be able to move pretty quickly, especially based on your feedback. And by looking at kind of how people are using the product, we'll be able to move really quickly on this one. And so there's a lot of other good stuff that will be coming soon. But the very first thing, first and foremost, it's kind of the nucleus of this push, is having this all-up list that you can browse through and eventually be able to search through. And so it pretty much just basic functionality. You can see the name. You can see whether it's a public or private, and it's sortable. And so looking ahead a little bit on this, The great thing about the groups integration, to contrast it with some other things, like if you're building like a shared mailbox or, you know, touch the third rail, say public folders, and or site mailboxes, in the past these have been a little more workload centric. You did them in SharePoint, you did them in Exchange, etc. This is absolutely first class citizen in 365, and it reads the common source of truth. So Sonia had a really great architecture diagram in her talk yesterday, where she talks about how Azure Active Directory is the basically Microsoft-level identity platform. This is talking only to the common source of truth directly. It's not talking just to Exchange, not talking just... So you're always getting exactly what the identity platform thinks that you're seeing. In the kind of early roadmap as we start to roll it out, we're still working on a lot of these details. So like there were questions yesterday kind of came up around like how's delete going to work and that kind of things. And Andrew was really clear that we're still working some of that out. But for compliance, keep in mind that there's going to be, as you've seen with all the demos for that Kamal and Quentin have done, there's going to be suite-level manageability of that, and so we're rationalizing some of that and then how it works out with groups. So some of that is still a little bit TBD that we'll be talking about next time. All right, so I just want to show a really simple click-through of how the admin experience will work for groups. So there's really only three or four basic things that we really want your feedback on, as far as that they're unique to the admin space. A guiding principle of this, again, was that we didn't necessarily want to duplicate everything that the IW can do, because we didn't want to burden the admin and we didn't want to create a bottleneck there, but we want you to feel very, very comfortable as the IT admin to fully, fully embrace and support this within your orgs. So one thing, there's a few unique things that you as the admins can do. You can delete any of the groups, one or more, through a bulk edit, have a scary message, are you sure you know what you're doing? And then you can go ahead and delete it. You can go to a group's property page. So if you go in through the edit mode of an individual group, and so this is, I'm not making any promises today. This is still work in progress, but this is probably something that you will be likely to see, or a version of this. So a single all-up list of members and admins for that individual group. So in this case, it was a group called the Contoso Market Research, And there's a few basic operations you can do. First of all, you can see everybody's in there, everybody who's an admin. And so this is still a work in progress, but it's likely that from that one list, you'll be able to filter to say, show me just the members, or show me just the admins. Who's currently a group admin just for this? And so it's Bob, it's Philip, it's George. And then if I want to make a change, now in most cases, if you need to add a member, we're really setting this up for success. And when Andrew and Sonia presented this too, the majority of the group level management should go through the IW group admin. You know, that can maybe be the same as the IT manager in some cases too. But if we want to just add a user, there's just going to be a fairly simple UI to say, I'm going to add this person. And you could either add them as a member and then make them an admin, or you could add them as an admin too. And lastly, we have what we call admin, group admin, promotion or demotion. So basically from that all up list, if a request comes in and it's like, oh, we lost all the admins in our group, or we need to make somebody else the group admin, you can say like, okay, someone's been vetted, they're gonna be the group admin now. And so you could just say like, yep, this person should be the group admin. There's a really beautiful way that works also in the IW scenario, where there's a right click menu in the IW experience, and then it's contextual based on the verb, either add or remove for an admin. That's a really nice way that the IW guys have done it too. Okay, and then of course you can remove one or more users. And lastly, before we get into more questions or go down to the expo, I want to just talk a little bit about kind of what's on the horizon and give one very fast demo, because we are kind of running out of time a little bit. Look for things like this coming soon to 365. So in the cloud, the suite level manageability experience, look for direct links to shared mailboxes. And yes, as Andrew pointed out yesterday, we're still rationalizing the model, how all our collaboration experiences with shared and public folders and everything else, site collections work. But that's a hot topic. We have that in EAC today. For a while, we didn't have that in EAC, and we got a lot of feedback about that. The ability to add secondary SMTP addresses. So this already exists in what we call the P, professional, kind of small business SKU. So believe it or not, the small business manageability experience in 365 got a little bit ahead of the enterprise experience, that they did a nicely integrated secondary SMTP proxy address. But that will be coming soon as well. And then lastly, I want to give a quick demo of something that we call global search for admins. All right, so if you are like myself and you're getting a little bit older, I'm gonna turn 40 this year, and I'm kind of forget where things are. I forget where my car keys are, don't forget my kids' names, that kind of thing. But I sometimes wonder, like, okay, I know where this something lives in Office 365. Where does that live in SharePoint? Where does it live in Exchange? So we have a new integrated all-up search experience that's pervasive. It's everywhere, where you on every page in 365. We call it Global Search for Admins, and it does a few very kind of hopefully interesting things that we'd love your feedback on as well. And you expect to, this is all live code. You expect to see this running through the service, through our concentric rings outwards pretty soon. So let's say that you want to do, we talked a little bit about mobile management today. So if you want to do mobile management, but maybe you're not an Exchange guru, you don't necessarily even really know what the Exchange Active Sync protocol is, but you know kind of what mobile is. So you just search on mobile. Ah, there's some suggestions in the type down. Mobile device access, that sounds kind of important. So I search on that. So there's a few things right here integrated in this page. Really importantly, these top ones, this is feature search across SharePoint, Exchange, Link, 365. We search all of these different information architectures, all of the consoles, and there's a deep link that will take you to manage these. So maybe I want to do mobile device management. That for today anyway, I have to do that in the Exchange Admin Center. So if I open that up, it will take me right there. Boom. One click. And also, I can get integrated community information to say, okay, how do I do that actually, and what should I do and what should I not do? And lastly, my favorite feature is that from anywhere in 365, you can also do what we call dynamic search. And the way that this works is that when I'm on any 365 page, if I want to search for a user or an individual group, I just typed that in. So if I search on Lide, there she is. Or if I search on myself, you can see a picture of this guy. So if I search on Lide, I can click on this, and it will take me straight to Lide's property page. And if I back up, I can also do group searches. And so we're still working out the kind of user experience of this, but if you notice that, like, if I search on a common name like Michael, I get all of the Michaels in my org, but I also get the groups. And so dynamic search works both for users and users across the org. Okay, a lot of related sessions. I think a lot of these have happened since this is the last day of MEC. So if you couldn't make it, I think we probably all went to the hybrid one, but there's a lot of other great sessions. Some of you guys went to the groups one yesterday too, the RBAC session. So you'll all have available to all of this this content online. Thank you very much. Oh, we will take questions. So we have a few minutes if people want to come up here and ask any questions. Please feel free.